Hello, this is Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, with me, Michael Kuehl.
And me, Roger Bell West.
And this, heaven help us, is episode 140. Have I got that right?
141, I believe.
Oh, for crying out loud. I must have slept through 140. And great events are apace in the world this autumn, and fates of nations and of men shall be decided by the ballot and by other means. But here in High Wycombe, we've got two aging white guys talking about role-playing games. And this month, we're going to talk about taking material from other sources and adapting it to our favourite game systems, our favourite game worlds, and, you know, making the most of anything we can steal.
But first, talking of taking things from other sources, thank you very much to these people who put some money in our tip jar. Glenn Lewis, Robert Wolfe, John Hagen, and Brian Parker.
We thank you, and we hope you enjoy what we've got coming up. But first. Those nice people at the Bundle of Holding continue to send us free samples. We're very grateful. Not so grateful as not to recommend things we don't like. But we will talk about things, even if we don't like them, which we find interesting. And Roger's had a skim of the latest offering. I haven't, so I shall look at him and I'll say, Roger, tell me about teeth.
Well, it's presented not just in its own blurb, but in people talking about it as a monster-hunting horror 18th century setting with a tinge of comedy. They talk about Blackadder, for example. Late 18th century, I should say. So yeah,
they also talk about Jane Austen in the blurb. So they're touching all of the classics.
Everybody talks about Jane Austen when they have a something between, you know, 1715 and 1915. They talk about Jane Austen.
It's true.
Ugh. Anyway. So this is... It gave me the impression of looking really interesting on that basis, because I would be absolutely up for that, and it sounds like a very Warts and All sort of game as well.
Yes. If it's got humour, then I think a Warts and All will eat it up.
They won't, but I'll come back to why. This is written by Jim Rossignol and Marsh Davis, whom I don't know before, but I gather are names in places where they are names. They are both video game journalists. I believe Rossignol is one of the founders of Rock Paper Shotgun, for example. So that may suggest something about their sensibility or B, their ages. I don't know.
That which you speak of would fit better in one of your other podcasts, Roger.
They probably weren't around when Blackadder was being broadcast first time round, put it that way.
All right, fair enough.
Anyway.
They are the classics to them.
So, I am all in favour of monster hunting with a bit of comedy set in 18th century England. That, to me, suggests a kind of Warhammer Fantasy roleplay sensibility.
Yeah, could be.
Got no problem with that. I want to mix up my monster hunting with Jacobite rebels hiding in the barn and heiresses who are not what they seem and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so the first thing I find is, no, there's a specific bit of England where the monsters are, and they're barely outside that at all. And there's a great big gate, and you go into Monster Hunt.
And I think,
Why did you say this was set in England when you just wanted to set it in generic...
A hole in England.
To be fair, there are some adventures included with this, and those do not pay any attention to this idea of there is one valley where the monsters are. They're quite happy to say there are monsters wherever you want them. So, yeah. But that was not a thing that encouraged
me. Lack of coordination amongst the design team, sounds like.
Also, you are not the lone brave monster hunters. There are lots of people who are monster hunters. And, look, it's based on Blades in the Dark.
That's a terribly sarcastic way to describe a very fine game system, much imitated. What's your problem in this particular case?
Well, that seems to go together. I mean, they don't actually use the crew-type mechanics from Blades in the Dark.
Yeah.
But they do have playbooks. It's in fact, feels more like Powered by the Apocalypse in terms of you must have one of these archetypes and you have very restricted things you can do with it.
I got the impression from reading the blurb that there was a level of crew involvement of of your company having another different purpose than just, you know, going out and hunting monsters.
Fair enough. I will admit I have not read the entirety of this offer, so I may well have missed that. But it did feel very, very restrictive. The adventures I've skimmed through are not only one-shots, but they are, here are the set of playbooks available to your characters, and indeed the characters have names. You know, these are effectively pre-gens.
Yeah.
But not pre-gens within the system that you're presented with. They're pre-gens with their own special unique abilities.
Okay, that's getting to be a killer problem for me as well, because I want this thing to be something I can... I want all game systems, to a degree, to be something I can generalise.
Well, Warts and Hall is absolutely down on Powered by the Apocalypse and quite suspicious of Blades in the Dark, though we may try it sometime.
Right, okay, so, well...
Sadly, I don't think there's going to be a go there, though we might try it anyway. I will give an example. This is a thing to bear in mind. These are objections that I raise about my use of this thing. And they may well not apply to you, they may well not apply to our audience, and that's why I wanted to talk about it, because there are some lovely ideas in here. Particularly using the setting. But, for example, one of the adventures is called Blood Cotillion. And what the PCs are doing, they are monster hunting assassiny types who are they know there is something dodgy going on in this particular grand house.
Yeah.
And their job is to infiltrate and root it out and destroy it. They are doing this during a formal party disguised as husband hunting ingenue.
Is any attention played to gender in
well, the pre-gens are all female.
Uh-huh. There's probably a good reason for that. I don't know. Probably.
It's probably this particular monster hunting society happens to do that. But anyway. So, I mean, that's a lovely idea. I would have great fun with that. And, you know, but the thing I would have great fun with is not the who is secretly abetting the monster. It's... Oh dear, what one of the servants dropped a tray of drinks and I snatched it out of the air. Now how do I make an excuse for that?
Yeah.
They're not writing this game for me, basically. That's true. Which is fair enough. But anyway, I'm not saying by this it's great, but I'm saying if you're interested in that sort of combination of setting, it might be worth a look. And that's running till the 11th of November.
One thing I extract from the blurb is that the characters are supposed to have a limited lifespan, limited by their tendency to become corrupt by using unnatural means. And I'm not sure if I love that, but I could see adding a certain flavour to the whole thing.
Well,
I'll give it a read.
The whole playbook system does tend to move pressure towards low-length campaigns anyway, so I'm not sure how important that would be.
Yes, true. Anyway, those of you who like this sort of thing may find it to be the sort of thing that you like.
Yeah. And there's an offer that sadly didn't line up with our release schedule. We would love to talk about it, which is Unknown Armies.
Yes, but...
you've already missed it by the time this comes out.
Opportunity missed, but though I do think I've not got to play the new Unknown Armies, which this is. I love the old system. And I'd certainly like to run or be involved with an Unknown Armies game in the new mode. But that may happen when it happens, and we'll let you know if it does. I have, just to give them a mention, I think I probably should, I have recently backed two Kickstarters. The Ars Magica Definitive Edition, which is going to be the compilation and regulation of all of the stuff that's been published for, all the rules-based stuff that's been published for 5th edition, which should be very interesting, if you want physical copies, very expensive. And
I believe they are Creative Commonsing at least some of the text, though.
Yeah, well, what they're doing is very interesting. They are publishing an open license for Ars Magica and allowing other people to create things for it and published their creative things for it, and starting with the Spanish group who's doing a tribunal setting for the Iberian Peninsula, which will be translated, which will be published in Spanish and translated into English. And people are burbling enthusiastically about the possibility of versions of the Order of Hermes set in other time periods, which is something many of us have been looking forward to for a while. Maybe somebody will even extract the system and apply it to other fantasy settings. We'd have to wait and see. The other thing I have backed is the latest set of supplements for Monster of the Week. Monster of the Week is a game I find very good for short campaigns and filler one-offs. And I'm basically I'm a sucker. I will back anything that that Evil Hat is willing to put out for this. I will put the link to the both of these Kickstarters into the show notes. But I thought you ought to know what I'm actually spending money on. I may actually get to run one of these days.
Well, while we're talking crowdfunding, running until the 8th of November, Trail of Cthulhu 2nd Edition.
Yeah, I decided not to on the grounds that I've not actually got to use Trail of Cthulhu since the first edition.
You've run at least one game of the Gumshoe system for me. I don't know whether it was Trail or something else.
I cannot recall. Where were you?
There was time travel involved.
Well, that seems likely. Oh, that would have been one of the other Gumshoe systems, Time Watch.
But in any case, the specific reason I mention it is because friend of the show Phil Masters has a campaign setting in it, Boundary of the Darkness, which is essentially the Lunar Society, of which you may have heard, and if you haven't, you should.
Oh, my word. Yes, that is... Erasmus Darwin against the mythos. Oh, wow.
And not just them, but some practicals they hire to do the tedious going about the country and investigating stuff.
And going mad stuff, yes. As well. Oh, well, in that case, I'm more inclined to bless the Enterprise. But good for Phil, and good luck to him too. Just a moment for me to pop in here and record at the last minute a mention of the very last offer that the Bundle of Holding did in their October-long Festival of Horror, which is the Dracula dossier, which they've offered before, and a campaign and a system which I have gone on about at considerable length in our previous podcasts. Needless to say, it is an improvised horror investigative scenario built around the idea that Dracula was originally a report to British intelligence about an unhappy set of attempts to recruit a vampire to serve the British Crown. Though, sometimes you just get these ideas coming out of think tanks and you just sort of have to go with them. But it's going to be on offer till, I think, the 13th of November, so there's plenty of time to pick this up if, for some unexplainable reason, you haven't already done so. And now, back to our regularly scheduled Farrago. Our vast prowling intellects are ever hungry and are gaping more for new material to be adapted and involved in our role-playing games. We've talked a lot about things we've done in the past and things we might do in the future. But we thought, Roger and I thought, that it might be a good idea to look at the various sorts of material you can adapt to a role-playing game, and the difference in the source that the source material makes. Briefly, if it's a book, or if it's a film, or if it's a comic, are there different rules? And are there rules you should follow in all cases to aid your creativity in other people's playing fields? We've mentioned in the past acquaintance of the podcast, William H. Stoddard's work, GURPS Adaptations, a basic outline on how to take stuff from other works and use them specifically in a GURPS adaptation. We like GURPS in this podcast, so we're probably going to mention it a lot. But it includes general principles on how to take an already imagined universe and turn it into something that you can create new stories in. Fair enough?
Yeah. I do think it does the process a disservice slightly because by the nature of the limited space of the book, it compresses what to me is very much a two-stage process into a single-stage process. The first stage is, I want to steal this thing. I'm going to be unapologetic here. You know, great artists steal and all that. I'm not claiming to pass this off as original material. The book is out there, whatever the book may be. But anyway, so stage one is I'm going to take these elements and from multiple places, and I'm going to build a campaign around them.
Hmm.
And stage two is, okay, and now how do I GURPSify it? And that may, in fact, be a different thing. I may get to the stage of, here is what will happen in the campaign, and think, well, actually, GURPS may not be the best fit for that. I'll do it with something else instead.
All right, well, let's set aside the system. We all have our favourite systems, though some are so specific and focused on one thing that if that thing doesn't apply to the setting you're using, then you're better moving it to somewhere else that either does focus on that thing or is a generic system, such as GURPS or RuneQuest or something genericizable.
I can't, see using Ars Magica for anything except something approximating Ars Magica, because the core of that, the bit that's fun, is the magic system, and the rest is quite generic.
Robin Laws did extract the D10 mechanic to use in Rune, but was never quite sure why he chose that as that particular thing. Perhaps because his publishers had access to it.
Yeah. But okay, so first of all, I think it's probably a requirement to say there are no truly original plots. Mm. There are, depending on whom you believe, some specific and small number of original plots. George Pulte said 36. So when you are stealing stuff, it's going to be recognisable, if not as itself, at least as the sort of thing that happens in a story.
Yeah, and if you're getting more specific, you are going to want to visit TV Tropes and lose several days going through the things which are parallel with what you're looking at, and things that you just encounter on the way. It's really a maddening sight, so useful.
Yeah, but a thing that I always say, which I'll expand on a bit, is steal from bad stuff rather than good stuff. This is partly because your players will be less likely to admit that they've read the thing, if it's really bad, if they spot where it came from, but mostly because it is less integrated.
Mm.
Quite often I will see something which is, okay, I've got the author clearly has this really good idea for a sort of story to tell, but they are perhaps inexperienced in fantasy or science fiction, so instead of doing a really good job of world building, they'll set it in generic fantasy land or generic space land.
Mm. Yeah. And think they're terribly original.
Yeah, because from the point of view of for example, a genre romance reader, things that are not set in the modern day or certain periods of history are already unusual.
I would put a note of caution in here that what you think of as the good stuff may be inaccessible to some of your players. We come in. You can't assume that people recognise things. I know what you mean about things coming from obscure locations, and But on one occasion when a friend of mine attempted to introduce an element from a particularly dodgy set of online erotica, which I somehow or other had become acquainted with, I took no time to tell him that if that's what he was using, no, thank you, no, very much, no,
I remember the details have vanished, but it was basically a Space Police book, and it was very bad indeed. I think it may have been called Space Precinct something, nothing to do with the Gerry Anderson series. It didn't aspire to those sort of heights. But what it did have was some really quite careful detail about we've got this Space Police Force, which basically looks like American Police Force, but its precincts, space stations, are in the middle of nowhere and you cannot get help for days or weeks.
Right.
So how does that affect their organisational structure? And the author had clearly really put some thought into that.
And that's what you wanted to steal.
That is the thing that I would steal, because that was the thing I enjoyed.
Yeah. I've got to say, I think the first stage at looking at any source of inspiration, of stealable ideas, is to make it clear, first of all, what it is that you want out of it, and then what the series is actually about. And to be clear in your own head what it's about, and to be clear what are the peripheral details. The book Starship Troopers is about a proposal for a society, and a military-based idea of ethics, which you may or may not find.
Let's put a great big pulsing red asterisk here and say that people have argued about whether it's military-based, and we're not going to get into that.
Let's also put a big set of quotation marks around ethics. Well, let's not, because ethics is what he thought he was talking about, and what he was going for. But there may be a slight sense of, quote, air quotes, ethics around that. But it also has these really cool powered armor suits, which are, a lot of the action of the novel is about, which has been imitated in dozens of other space military stories since.
Yeah, that's another consideration. If something has been widely copied, that's a good sign that that's an easy bit to steal. But also, generally what gets copied is the stuff that is easy to copy.
Yes, that's true.
I'm thinking, for example, of the film Halloween, the original one, which had several official sequels and many, many imitators. But it is quite hard to find the best young actress of her generation and put her in the lead when she's never had a significant part before. And so the others didn't bother to do that. They just picked young women who were prepared to take their tops off on screen. and
we can't all be high artists, Roger. Though in role playing games, I don't see why we can't all be high artists.
Yeah, but you don't have her. You don't have the solid film that rests on a really stunning core performance, and then the horror gimmicks and all the rest of it. So, yeah.
I was going to say, War of the Worlds is about colonialism. It's about imagining what it would be like for the smug population of early 20th century Britain to find themselves in the position of the natives who have been conquered by superior technology. But it also has giant war machines. And I'd say in that case, the giant alien tripod war machines are as much at the core of the story and as much what people come for as the moralising and the emotional projection. And I think sometimes the what looks trivial and what is at the core are so strongly intertwined that you really shouldn't try to separate them. But that's not in every case.
Yeah, well, considering Starship Troopers, I will remind you, even though you've probably purged it from your memory, that there was a film.
I have never seen the film. I have seen extracts from it, and they were painful enough. Thank you.
Yeah, so, I mean, A, they didn't have powered armour.
Yeah, because...
But also, B...
Budget.
And this is... Yeah, but because it was Paul Verhoeven... He was much more interested in saying, here is this militaristic society which is blatantly fascist, but it's got it's fascism with a smiling face. How might that look? And that's that's where he gets the background stuff from.
Yeah.
And then there's this fairly generic war story on the front of it.
I think you should never adapt something that you don't have affection for. At least for a role-playing game, your characters... And you are going to be too much involved in it. And I don't like the idea of taking somebody else's work and taking the piss out of it. But maybe I am fussy about that.
May come back to that a bit.
All right.
I'd just like to give another example. The Forever War, Joe Haldeman. To some extent, it is his Vietnam-era answer to Starship Troopers.
As Bill the Galactic Hero was Harry Harrison's Korean War answer to Starship Troopers.
And it's very much an anti-war book. Mm. John Darmod, friend of the podcast again, had a friend who had read Starship Troopers. He was getting into the whole military virtue worldview. He was into Dorsai. John lent him the Forever War, wondering what was going to happen. His only comment was, I like the Nova Bombs. So, yeah.
oh, dear.
So, another thing I'd like to look at. A lot of books, stories in general, what they are about is, to a large extent, the big story.
Mm-hmm.
The Lord of the Rings would be an obvious example.
Yeah.
And you can tell side stories in it, like The Hobbit, like all of Tolkien's laundry lists, but fundamentally the story that universe is designed to tell is that story, and it's already been told.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do it. I mean, I've known people who have set out to rerun The Lord of the Rings as a role-playing campaign. I don't think they got very far, but the principle is there. Or you can say, okay, let's just ignore that story because we all know how that one works. And, either we're going to stick to the script or we're not, and either way it's going to get weird.
Mm.
But use the setting. And one thing I know Bill has done is use the setting in a different era.
Yeah, prequels or sequels. You look at something like... a lot of the Star Trek intellectual property that is being produced nowadays is set in different eras and giving different takes on already told stories. Strange New Worlds is Enterprise before Captain Kirk came aboard, before Dr. McCoy, but with Spock and Captain Pike. Enterprise is about the very first Starship Enterprise. And they jump about all over the place, and I hope the people who are managing the property are going to be able to reconcile all of the stuff they're throwing at the wall and seeing if it sticks.
Well, they did a fairly effective character assassination of both Picard and the entire institution of Starfleet in Picard, but hey, who cares right? What I would like to mention in this context, though, is Lower Decks, animated, largely comedy series, because it's not perfect by any means, but it is clearly written by people who either are or are closely informed by people who are fans of the micro-continuity, and here is a thing that was on screen for, two scenes of one episode that hardly anybody remembers, and they will happily bring that back and say, yeah, isn't that kind of silly? One of the lovely sight gags is the megalomaniac computer containment facility. because there are just so many of them that and each one of them, they've got, I don't know, 40 cells or something on screen, and each one of those is recognisable if you are a sufficient Star Trek geek.
It's
also doing the same era when the exciting stuff is happening, but somewhere else. These guys are not the glamorous exploration ship; they are the support ship, and they get the boring cleanup jobs. You know, somebody else has done the first contact, and now you do the second contact. That kind of thing,
and then discover what the problems actually are.
All right.
This obviously is the counter example to my dislike for people who are taking the Mickey out of the original property. These people are in love with the property and are making fun of it at the same time. But you will notice that their lower deck ensigns and lieutenants are still triumphing despite the goofiness and the mockery of the standard Starfleet troops tropes.
It's not saying this whole system is rotten. It is saying perhaps once you become known as a success and glory boy, you may get more of that. But it's not saying we have to overthrow the entire system because it's broken. It's saying, well, yeah, okay, it's not great if you're not one of the glory boys, but it's still survivable.
I've not watched it all. I don't think they've done a serious critique of Gene Roddenberry's utopian future.
Deep Space Nine did that. that was the first show where they managed to prise his fingers off the controls. So,
all right. So let's start by. I want to divide the sources we can draw from into two basic sources. There are the performed arts, which are theatre, radio theatre, film and television, in as much as there's a difference nowadays, and maybe even computer games. But they're arts that show you, if only in sound, what the world is like, which might embody the world and its characters. And written is different. Written is going to give you different things about a setting and different levels of involvement and description. And let's start from the beginning and say that these are going to create different expectations in the minds of anybody who sees it. Mm-hmm. And different things that you're going to have to, allow for and can make use of. The design of a piece of equipment, or the look of the uniforms, or the appearance of the aliens, is different. And I suppose we ought to include comics in the depicting arts rather than describing arts. But you're going to get to learn much more about the characters, their backgrounds, their reactions, what they're like. That sort of expectation is going to be built up more strongly in a read work than a viewed work, I think is going to be true.
And I think there's a correlation. My own personal bias for entertainment is towards the written, but I think from a book I'm more likely to steal an individual character, whereas from a setting I'm more likely to take the entire feel of the thing, as with the Firefly game that I ran for you and some others.
Yeah, and I did find Firefly terribly impressive from its from that particular point of view. We were feeling the oppression of the Parliament all the way through, I think. But all right, so you've chosen a particular thing. How much of it do you want? A particular setting, not just one character or one piece of equipment or one bit of plot, but you've chosen a whole setting. How much of it do you want to keep? And how much of it do you want to reimagine somewhere else? Somewhere not bounded by the plot of... by the saga of what the already existing work allows?
Well, to me, there is a dividing line between, say, a Firefly game and a you are generic space scum trying to keep your ship together and the law doesn't like you much game, which could look very like Firefly, or it could look very like Classic Traveller or various other ways.
Yeah, and that is another source of adaptation, other games. But I'm not quite sure how, if we should include them here. It's sort of off topic, but I always thought Firefly...
I'm an equal opportunity thief.
Fair enough. I always thought Firefly was somebody's Traveller campaign, trying to make sense of the way the low-level freighters in Traveller behave, keep constantly slipping in and out of legality.
The various people involved in building it have claimed that it wasn't, and they've also claimed that they'd never seen Blake 7, and they've claimed a lot of things, many of which we know were untrue, so, yeah, sure.
Oh, well. So what were you saying before I so rudely interrupted?
Did you? I think One thing that became apparent with Firefly and why I entered the campaign when I did was that they really didn't build much of the universe beyond what was needed for the show.
This is always wise, I feel. There's that moment in an Adventure in Time and Space, the story of the first Doctor Who, the producer tells the director, cut out all that background stuff about the Doctor and Susan, leave it vague. And as it's gone on through the decades, and as it's accumulated more and more lore, and as the newer script editors have started to revolt against that lore, you can see the wisdom of that.
Mm.
Only specify stuff when it's necessary. On the other hand...
Yes, true, but the thing I found restrictive was that, well, all right, so we've got this stuff that's on the planets that we've seen, and some third parties have produced things like names of all the other planets and rough ideas of where they are and their populations. There are some rather nice third-party maps. But... Okay, are there any people on these planets who aren't starving farmers who are so desperate that they will try to rob a visiting ship?
Yes, there are, but not on the planets you want to visit.
I was feeling constrained in terms of the sort of thing I could do without going well outside anything that Firefly seemed to represent.
Firefly hinted at the inner, rich, smug planets.
There's one visit to it with the hospital and the ambulance, but yeah.
I think what you have to do when taking somebody else's source material, something that struck you, is to divide it up into classes of stuff that you want to borrow and classes of stuff if you have to borrow if they're going to be consistent in your new creation. So I think there's characters, but the characters also depend on some sort of social background. You don't get Miles Vorkosigan without the peculiar nature of the nobility of his home world. There's societies, there's individuals, there's stuff. That equipment is something. Bill Stoddard talks about a lot, but stuff can also be magic systems and ideas of how the universe works.
Yeah, I will admit that in the things that I read and watch for pleasure, the equipment is not generally of paramount importance. I mean, it may enable the campaign to happen, as with, for example, something like your Stargate. Yeah. The point of it is that we can go through the Stargate and do stuff. But
you do find yourself...
The story is about the people and how they react to the weird situations more than it is about, well, we can go to other planets.
Yeah, but you also need... I found when I did a Victorian version of the Stargate saga that I had to get into my own head very clearly the way the system worked and the way I was abusing it. Because my players asked. And they say, why can't we go through the gate except under these specific circumstances? Mm. And I sometimes had to come up with waffle at very short notice. And it helps if you've thought ahead for your justification of how things work.
Yeah, and as we've already been saying, I think that is... it's not always a lazy author's thing just to say, oh, well, they didn't think of it going there, or they didn't think of that solution. There are perfectly good reasons why the people might not think of it in that situation, but your players are not under stress. Well, maybe some of them are, but they're not under as much stress as the characters are.
No.
They will tend to think of things that it's jolly... Let's face it, Murphy's Law. They will think of the things that it is most inconvenient for you for them to think of.
So, yes, you've got to be able to say, it is lazy. Sometimes you do actually have to say, look, we are telling the story of these knights and not the story of the peasants labouring out in the fields. Interesting though that may be, and possibly even much, much more important in the long term than the knights poncing around on their big horses with the heavy armour. But this is the story we're telling now.
Yeah, but arguably that's something for a session zero. The campaign is going to be about this rather than...
Yeah. About the whole world. In no circumstances do you get to do the whole world because you are not God. Sometimes you're not even a very competent GM sometimes. And so you owe as much new creation to flesh things out as is necessary, but sometimes no more.
Mm. I think is the point of various schools of bottom-up world design and so on. If the campaign never travels beyond this three county area where we all grew up and where the monsters are coming to attack us, then we don't need to know much about the rest of the world, especially if it's a medieval type society where, you know, that doesn't really affect our lives. We know there's a king over there somewhere, and we think he's called Henry because the tax collector says in the name of King Henry, but that's all we know about him.
Yeah. And on the other hand, it can be fun to take them out of their immediate vicinity and into the wider world. But you don't... You can list the names of the foreign countries and the titles of their rulers, but you don't need to have more than that for them. There's a republic over there, there's a sheikdom over there, and the words republic and sheikh bring shadows and numinous implications with them, but you don't need to go into full details until or if it's absolutely necessary.
Though I would say one way of being fairly lazy but not looking quite as lazy is mixing things up a bit. You know, the sheikh is ruling a land which is a hostile environment. Well, maybe it's an ice field, damn it, rather than yet another desert.
All right, fair enough. And maybe the Republic allows only women to vote instead of only men, only mothers for that matter. And maybe think that you let them trip over their assumptions when they finally go there, which can be fun. I was going to say we've talked about prequels and sequels. We've talked about games in the same universe that are happening at other times. There's also the reimagining, which can be a large scale or small scale, which is more like an exercise in taking what you think was good and redoing the things you thought were naff.
Mm.
And the I think that's very interesting. I think there comes a point where you don't want to say this is a reimagining. You want to say this is a different universe with some of the same themes. And those are very different things.
I think in things that are for publication, it is helpful to say this is a reimagining of so that the owners of the original don't sue you.
I think the phrase you want there is this is inspired by rather than this is a reimagining of. But a reimagining is what Strange New Worlds is doing to Kirk era Star Trek, which looks a lot different and feels a lot different as well. Though it's further along the path of liberal inclusionism than the original was, though it was a pioneer in its day.
Yeah, I think it was. What was the one before Strange New Worlds? The one that was supposed to be the early days of Starfleet.
A Discovery.
Yes. In which, I mean, you make it for the time it's made in, fair enough, but when the control panels are clearly vastly more sophisticated than the control panels of the 1960s props that are supposed to be the super advanced stuff that's coming in 10 years, it doesn't look right. Make it look right, guys.
I'm not sure in that case it can be made to look right. You have to sometimes just let the past's future be the past, I think, if that sentence makes sense.
There's probably time travel involved. Time travel breaks everything.
The Star Trek universe has been broken nearly as many times as the Hooniverse has. And one of these days, they're going to have to address that.
But this comes back to these steel bad things. You're talking about Miles Vorkosigan. Miles Vorkosigan is very much only the sort of person who could come from that society. And at the very least, you need a world that has been isolated from galactic civilization for a while and has relatively recently rejoined it. It's had to get along on its own for a bit, and it's had to deal with the results of various unpleasant wars and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And by the time you've got that much, you might as well run a Miles Vorkosigan campaign. Or at least in that setting. I think a thing Bill did was the generation after him. So Miles is still around or possibly dying soon because of all the genetic damage and so on. But, you know, he is a distant parental figure if he's about at all, and his children and various other people's children have got to solve their own problems.
Well, that is one good way of getting away from the problem of the single protagonist story. Mm. And Miles is going about solving all the problems of everybody all the time. And if he's not, he wants to stick his nose in and have his say about how other people should fix it.
Yeah.
But role-playing is a group activity. Mostly there are exceptions.
We've done one of them, but yeah.
Yeah, And I'm sure there are lots of people doing solo adventures for characters in their group campaigns as well. But if you want a group, it's a good way of going on to the next generation or people in the same universe at the same time, but who aren't all as totally wonderful as the central character. And
yeah, I'm just reminded of Doc Savage.
Yeah,
he has these five assistants, but he can do anything that any of them could do better. It seems to me that if you're running a Doc Savage game, what you play is one of the assistants, and Doc tells you to go and do something while he deals with something even more important over there.
See the doctor pass him. I think you would. If that were happening, I would probably want to be further away from the centre of Doc Savage universe and further away from the Doctor.
Yeah, but it barely exists as a distinct thing except for the Doc himself, surely. And the things that directly contact him.
There are lots of settings, bits of the Doctor that are thrown out with little regard and are too good for one episode. I'm thinking particularly of the Galactic Emperor, who is who is a small person. I think that's the current polite statement. He suffers from dwarfism, and he's another Miles Vorkosigan type, but he's at the top of an empire that is constantly struggling against the Cybermen and has to go out and sometimes do terrible things. And I thought that was a lovely bit of setting that could have been reused and could have seen more stuff. But there are other examples of things that happen in the Hooniverse that could well get their own series and could well get their own campaigns.
Some of them have.
Yes, this is true. And not enough of them, as far as I'm concerned. But
I have occasionally considered running this, and my primary approach is probably something like Unit when the Doctor isn't about.
Yeah, there are supplements for that. I'm not quite sure what the Victorian Monster Hunters, led by two aliens, is quite a nice idea. There's only three of them, but if I had only three players, I'd definitely give that a try.
The other thing is, of course, just thinking about multiple protagonist stories, TV is probably the best model for this. I'm thinking, for example, the CSI shows, which is something I come back to a lot, because I think they do some basic things quite well. They also do some other things very badly. But so you've got your four or five primary cast.
Yeah.
Who are the team. But generally, you actually use them by ones and twos. You know, two of them are going to a crime scene and studying it and talking to each other about what they're finding. Or one of them is looking down a microscope while interesting music is playing, and he goes, aha. You don't get a lot of the thing that role-playing games tend towards, which is effectively you glob up the entire team into a single protagonist, and they all throw in the things they want to say when they want to say it. Sometimes, if one's trying to be realistic, this can be quite messy. You know, we are visiting someone who's had an absolutely terrifying experience and is only barely willing to talk to us in the first place, and six of us roll up, some of us with distinctly illegal weapons.
Well,
you send the one charismatic person to be reassuring.
Well, one charismatic person plus somebody for backup in case things turn nasty, and a witness. I think that I read something, and I can't remember by who, which said that in investigative campaigns you have to split the party, and it's a good thing to do. I'd also mention Primetime Adventures, which introduced the idea of this person. This episode is this person's spotlight episode, and they get more resources to do things than the others in this episode, which I think is a discipline that could be introduced into other systems. It's
at least half the times I've tried to do something along those lines, that player hasn't turned up for that session.
Yeah, you have to be adaptable. Let me change the plot suddenly. I've got a spare plot over here.
Oh yeah, always have spare plot. The one thing I would say is probably not worth stealing at all, or at least rarely, is the extremely destined or born for greatness or whatever PC that the one who has a particular background that will pay off sometime in the future, because you just know they're going to find a way to die in a riding accident or something before that ever comes true.
I think that mystic fate should probably float about a bit, and all right. There's an idea. How about an entity of some mystic sort, a ghost or a god, who is hanging around with the group, waiting to decide which one is going to get to be destined? I think that's a lovely idea, and something that, of course, the players, if they figure this out, may desperately try to ensure the player they don't like is going to get to be destined, or the player who is going to be most awkward is going to get to be destined. But that's players.
Well, here's another thing. Campaign rule for the PCs. Any PC will be somebody who has the mystic birthmark of a crown on their shoulder and maybe the future king. But everybody knows there are quite a few of these people. You lot happen to be friends.
Yes, somebody
is. But even if you fight off all the competition, only one of you is actually going to get to be king.
I think I mentioned to you a while back the emperor, the competition to be emperor in the Emperor Eye of the Petal Throne. The second prize is you get sacrificed, but you do get a fair chance to succeed to your imperial parent, along with all the other over-enthusiastic buggers who've turned up. The skill is ensuring you're the only one who is present.
I'm getting flashbacks to advice on playing Paranoia.
Yeah.
The ideal phrase to be able to use in your mission report is, I speak without fear of contradiction.
Yeah. All right. Have we covered this?
I would just like to mention one last thing, which is a bit specific.
Yeah.
But good advice in general, and I think I've mentioned this before, GURPS Mysteries.
Yes.
By Lisa Steele. Has a splendid introductory chapter on how to create a mystery adventure.
Yeah.
Specifically saying it is not like real life. Real life has these characteristics which you don't want in a game, but you know, if you're stealing from a real crime report, here is how to change it. They're not like books, and here is why. And again, you know, if you want to take the book thing, here is the stuff to change. And indeed, other RPG adventures are her third example of things that RPG mysteries are not like, if they're good ones. And I think, although it is obviously focused on the mystery adventure, I think it is good advice in general for adapting from books or indeed real life.
All right. I think I shall conclude this section by saying that the thing you should be stealing from all the time is real life, is start with Earth. To quote Ken Haidt, let me quote Ken Haidt. It is one of the things I frequently say. Start with Earth. Earth has more resonance and more depth than anything else you're going to find.
I did once run a campaign inspired entirely by Florida Man news stories.
They're still happening. Yeah. Onward. Just as a sort of worked exercise in the adaptation process, I'd like to boost another part of Roger's podcast empire, Ribbon of Memes, which is his and Nick Marsh's delve into the masterpieces of cinema. And they recently asked me on as a guest contributor to talk about Orson Welles' film about Falstaff, mostly, Chimes at Midnight. It'll be out sometime later this month, but I encourage you all to go and have a look at Ribbon of Memes in any case, because I find it fun. It's got a one.
There will be a link in the show notes anyway.
Okay. Now, I explain a lot about Falstaff, his history and the history of the person who he was based on, Sir John Oldcastle, in the Ribbon of Memes episode. So I think I'm going to say here, take a moment to go and listen to that or read up on Sir John Falstaff and Sir John Oldcastle in Wikipedia. Either will do, because where do you think I got my inspiration from?
So I think it would be fair to say the short version is Sir John Oldcastle is a knight. He is the companion of the young future Henry V. But he fairly early on goes all heretical and meets a bad end.
Yeah, and Sir John Falstaff is the literary version of an earlier literary version of the same person. And Shakespeare creates one of the great comic characters of his repertoire, a fat, lying, thieving, whoremongering, utterly shameless, and utterly contemptuous of all knightly virtues, comic character, who dies when the prince who has been his patron rejects him when he becomes king. Now, this is a wonderful character for, as I say, for inspiration. Go and have a look at the other podcast. And it occurred to me that there were three or four things I wanted to take from this and could adapt to a role-playing campaign. First is Falstaff himself. He's one of those overbearing characters who dominates all around him. But he does have a group of minions, friends, acquaintances, a group of people who he can trust to do illegal things and who'll be on his side and who he will let down a lot. There's the prince himself, and there's Ned Poins, who is a slightly more serious mercenary, and there's Pistol and Bardolph and Nim, who are less detailed, but have their own characteristics. And they would make a good group of criminal conspirators, or it occurred to me, maybe a good group of agents for the Crown. Because one alternative use of Falstaff might be that he's working for the king all along and doing the things that the king is ashamed of doing.
Falstaff as Walsingham.
Falstaff as Walsingham. Falstaff as my version of, oh, what's he called? The dwarf in... my version of Sir Dagonet, King Arthur's jester, also has him as his intelligence chief. And I think I must be riffing off that. And furthermore, you could have Falstaff and his merry group investigating all sorts of weird stuff. If you've got Owen Glyndwr, who is supposed to be a wizard, as one of the villains or at least enemies of the peace. So that's taking Falstaff as he is in the plays and using him. It's also taking bits of the play's background and perverting that. And I think this becomes, very quickly, an alternate history or reimagining. I think this counts as a reimagining of Falstaff. And I don't think we need blush about it because I think he's out of copyright. So that was the first thought that I had. The second thought was, what about Sir John Oldcastle? What about making this about the real person? Do you think you could run a campaign in which you're playing the Lollard Resistance or the Lollard Revolution? It's immensely ahistorical for them to succeed, but maybe you could rewrite history so that... Oh, all right, so that they... It's them who aligns with the last wizard prince of Wales, and rather than that idiot Hotspur, as it is in the plays.
Or you could say, well, we know we have little hope of success, but it's not only our souls; it's the souls of everyone in England at stake here.
Yeah,
we must save them from their error that the Catholic Church has allowed them to fall into.
It has to be noted that, as far as we can tell, Sir John Oldcastle's intent was to slaughter the entire nobility, which sounds better on paper than it does in practice, but that he didn't have the experience of later revolutions to give him pause.
For listeners unfamiliar with the gunpowder plot, do look up what the next stages after the destruction of Parliament and the King were meant to be.
Yeah,
there's a lot of, and then a miracle happens.
Yeah, but where if you want to pull it that way, you might actually run a very dark campaign with Falstaff and his heretical conspiracy gradually becoming aware that they have paid too high a price for the services of a wizard, and that Owen Glyndwr is neither a blowhard nor Merlin, but something rather nastier. I think that might work.
You know all those people you said were stepping stones on your road to power? Well, somebody is stepping on your head now.
I think that's what I can extract. You might want to take this to being a more generic fantasy thing, and I can see repurposing the knight who does things that respectable kings don't want to touch, being a figure in a lot of possible fantasy settings, including ones I'd make up myself.
Well, here's another angle that's occurring to me as we're talking about this, and I will admit this is a trope that I'm quite fond of in various forms, but Falstaff is, in fact, working for the old king, and his job is to let the young future king get all the roistering out of his system in a relatively safe context.
Could be, but I wouldn't call anyone near Dol Tearsheet a safe context.
Well, she's a professional.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yeah.
But the way this can move on is that, with a little modification, he becomes the disgraced former friend of the new king, which obviously makes him a magnet for plots.
It's true.
And if he actually is a friend, secretly a friend of the new king, then he can say, yes, yes, we will attack tomorrow. Oh, look, you all got arrested tonight.
Yeah, that's only so often. You can pull that trick before people start suspecting. You could run a campaign in which he and his merry band are infiltrating more serious enemies of the king. But I think Falstaff, the plausibly deniable, might well be something. The thing is that you've got this picture of Henry V as being a noble and chivalrous and idealish sort of king, but he also has a bloody-minded and ruthless streak. I think,
which, to be fair, in the context of the original plays, was a characteristic expected of a king.
Yeah. I think you might even do it that Falstaff turns into the king's conscience later in the scenario. There may come a point at which the king decides to no longer show mercy to Falstaff. That might be interesting too, but short term, I think yes, Falstaff, Ned Poins, and the rest as deniable assets has some mileage in it.
Yeah, and for a player character group, the idea of his various hangers on is certainly reasonable. They can come from practically any sort of background. All they need is a liking for wine at a discount,
and a willingness to rob pilgrims when the opportunity arises.
Well, they're probably Catholic pilgrims, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that was the subtext of what was. of what was going on, and given how Shakespeare's family is supposed to have been recusants, according to some authorities, then maybe there's another layer of ambiguity going on there. But yes, they are Catholics, and by the time the end of Henry the Fourth Part Two comes. There's an epilogue which says, no, honestly, this isn't Sir John Oldcastle. Sir John Oldcastle was a martyr, and we all know they're good guys. So we're not saying, no, this isn't Sir John Oldcastle. Please, terrible mistake. Please ignore all the early copies of the play script. Umph.
Especially if you happen to be one of his relatives.
Yes. Umph. See the other podcast for that story. But that, I think, is an exercise in taking on a core idea and wringing all you can out of it. We hope it pleased you. And we will see you again next time. If you want our advice or even criticism about the thing you've been meaning to adapt, then do drop us a line. You can contact us by
Leaving a message on the website or email podcast@tekeli.li.
And we hope we will see you again next month.